In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the increasing connections that we've seen over time, particularly over the last few decades, between the world's politics and the world of show business. And very specifically, when we're talking about the world of politics, we're talking about the presidency. Our guest for this part of the show is Alan Schroeder. He's associate professor in the School of Journalism at Northeastern University. He is also a three-time Emmy Award-winning television producer and frequent media commentator. He is the author of a recently published book that we'll be talking about. The title of the book is Celebrity in Chief, How Show Business Took Over the White House. It is out just now, published by the Westview Press. So if you'd like to take a look at it, it's out there in the bookstore. He's also author of another book entitled Presidential Debates, 40 Years of High Risk TV. And he is joining us this morning by telephone as we talk. Of course, questions, comments are welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call is that they are brief. And we just ask that so that we can try to accommodate as many different people as possible keep the program moving along. But of course, anybody who is interested is welcome to call here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. Also, the toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, that's 800-222-9455. So whichever number works for you, you just pick up the telephone and give us a call. Professor Schroeder, hello.
Yes, hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us
today. My pleasure. Thank you.
We appreciate it. I think that one thing that we have to acknowledge is that presidents, like most of us, are fascinated by celebrities. They're just as liable to be seduced by that. But what's kind of interesting here, I guess, is that the relationship is mutual, and that presidents, all politicians, but presidents in particular, have a certain kind of star power. And of course, celebrities do too. And what you see is, if you look at the history that you have, is that entertainers and presidents are fascinated by each other. And that, in fact, it seems that on both sides, they feel that some of the kind of star power that the other has will rub off on them. So whereas presidents seem to like to be seen with entertainers, it works the other way around too. Is that
oh, yeah.
they're just as sort of starstruck.
Absolutely.
Movie stars can be just as starstruck by being with the president as the other way around.
Yeah, that's right. There is a mutual admiration society that goes on between entertainers and presidents, although I should say that there's also a lot of variety depending on the president as to how that relationship manifests itself. For instance, George W. Bush is not particularly enamored of the show business community or interested by the popular culture, and they reciprocate by not having much allegiance to him. Contrast that with Bill Clinton, who was kind of the ultimate show business president. So a lot of that relationship really hinges on the individual president and his particular tastes.
Yeah. Well, I think that's interesting. That points up the fact that in the popular perception, there is this idea that the world of show business is liberal, and that would be maybe one reason why the current president wouldn't want to be associated with them. And I don't know that anybody's ever sat down and figured it out, but certainly we know that there are celebrities who are politically conservative and are also willing to stand up and endorse conservative candidates and endorse conservative points of view. So it's not, Hollywood is not monolithic, although I don't know, maybe it does.
Well, it isn't monolithic, but it definitely weights more in the direction of liberals and specifically Democrats. It's interesting, as you go back through history, which is what I did in my book, and trace that relationship, you do see that the Democrats, beginning with Franklin Roosevelt, really seem to have a more natural bond and a more natural affinity for entertainers. There have been Republicans who have pursued it fairly aggressively. However, Dwight Eisenhower actually was quite beloved by the show business community, and I think was probably the most successful Republican in terms of having that relationship. Of course, Ronald Reagan is such an interesting example in this discussion on many different levels, but the fact that he came out of that community and those people were his peers and his friends, obviously not all of them supported him, But I think you can make a case that there's a relationship there, definitely, and support even from the piece of that Hollywood community that, that had worked with him and who were friends with him. Mm. So this question does tend to predominate on the Democratic side, but even Republicans who haven't been terribly successful have tried in one way or another. Richard Nixon is a great example, who maybe we can talk about a little later, mm-hmm. of somebody who really desperately sought that approval and worked pretty hard to get it, but never quite closed the deal.
Yeah, he obviously seemed, when you saw him pictured with people like that, he was obviously uncomfortable, mm-hmm. and didn't quite know how to talk with him, didn't know how to bridge that gap.
Yeah, I think that's right. And yet he's an interesting figure in this, because he's the only president in American history who actually grew up in Southern California, and at the time the movie business was just coming into its own. So he was very, I think, in some way influenced by that. As a young man, Nixon wanted to be an actor, and Nixon took part in dramatic performances at his college and was quite smitten with the idea of the entertainment community. And in later life, when he began mingling with them, he remained fairly starstruck. But you're absolutely right. You look at the photographic evidence, which is what exists for us today, and you can palpably sense that lack of ease in the presence of entertainers. You know, Nixon would have loved to have some of that natural grace in front of the camera that they had, but he just couldn't quite swing it.
Yeah. Well, that does get you thinking about how, to the extent to which being president of the United States is a kind of a performance art. And I'm reminded of the quote from Reagan, who was, after all, the only actor to become president. He said something to the effect of, "I don't see how anybody could be president if they hadn't been an actor."
That's exactly what he said. He said it at the end of his 8 years as president, in an interview with David Brinkley. And it's interesting that he, you know, even after all of that time in the White House, after two terms, that he would still come to that conclusion. And I think that it does point to a facet of the presidency that is very much performance-oriented, and that some presidents have been very gifted at and others seem to lack a knack for almost altogether.
Mm. You point out in the book that sort of the modern age of this association between the presidency and the world of entertainment does start with Franklin Roosevelt, and although probably the person who brought it to its real high point would have been John Kennedy.
Right.
But this association does go back, and it, again, as we were talking about in the beginning, presidents seem just as fascinated with celebrities as anybody else. And I guess the one image that I really love thinking about is the, and you mentioned it just in passing in the book, is the meeting of Abraham Lincoln and the celebrated small person, General Tom Thumb.
That's right.
Who was kind of a P.T. Barnum kind of employee, I think, who was a midget, I guess. I don't know what's the approved term these days, but I think that's what you would call him. And that apparently he came to the White House, and the story is that Lincoln actually broke up a cabinet meeting so he could meet Tom Thumb. I guess there are no photographs of this event.
No,
I would like, that's something. That's one picture I'd like to see.
Isn't that the truth? That would have been sort of the Nixon and Elvis of its day, right? But I think that's an excellent point, that you can go back a long way in American history and begin to see that fascination there. Tom Thumb showed up with his wife, who was another small person. Her name was Lavinia, and she was also a performer in the Barnum & Bailey Circus. And throughout the years, presidents have drawn other entertainers to the White House, often in the context of performance, people who have come to the White House to entertain. But so even as early as that, where it really kicks off, though, is with the spread of mass media. And an interesting, very early example is in 1918, when during World War I, several top Hollywood stars of the day, Charlie Chaplin, Mary Pickford, and Douglas Fairbanks, came to Washington to do a war bond drive on behalf of Woodrow Wilson, met Wilson at the White House. They caused a huge stir in Washington because they were such popular figures. And so even as early as the 19-teens, the White House was cognizant of the power of celebrities to highlight a message or to bring attention to something. And so it really even predates Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah. It seems to be the case that has been for a long time, that when presidents have important foreign visitors, one of the things that they that is the president, likes to do to impress the visitor is to invite celebrities so that they can mix it up with because obviously those people know they are the foreign visitors. If you're the president of Russia, you know Hollywood stars, and if Sharon Stone was at the party, no doubt you'd be impressed.
Oh yeah, absolutely. They definitely use that opportunity. They also use that opportunity to have performers come to the White House and entertain foreign dignitaries. And there've been just hundreds of examples of that. One of my favorites, just because it was so strange, was in the mid '60s. Lyndon Johnson gave a state dinner for the Emir of Kuwait, and for this distinguished crowd of Kuwaiti royalty who came in for the event, they did a hootenanny show. Remember those big in the mid-60s?
Yeah.
And apparently the sheikhs from Kuwait just sat out in the audience with this absolutely mystified look on their faces. They had no idea what was going on. And you have to question, sometimes it gets almost a little silly, the matching of entertainers to visitors. The Reagan White House once, when the Chancellor of Germany came, had Joel Grey come in and do selections from Cabaret, and that always struck me as a little odd. Why would you, kind of revisit the whole Nazi era if your visitor was the leader of Germany? But there are all of these kind of strange juxtapositions in putting entertainers with presidents and foreign dignitaries.
Yeah, probably the only thing worse would have been to have someone come and do selections from the producers.
Yeah, right. Well, that could be down the line. I would not rule anything out.
I also, one of the stories that's on earlier in the book that it really tickles me is the story of it was during the Nixon administration and Leonid Brezhnev was visiting and they invited a bunch of entertainers. And one of the people who was there was Red Skelton, and there was a receiving line and the entertainers were going through meeting Brezhnev. And so Skelton comes up to Brezhnev and says, "Are you a card-carrying communist?"
That's right. And supposedly when Brezhnev got the translation, he thought it was quite funny. I don't know that he would have appreciated that reference to the degree Americans would. Brezhnev was also entertained. Nixon brought a bunch of Western stars to his home in San Clemente when Brezhnev visited for a summit. And Brezhnev had always been a big fan of Westerns, and so the opportunity to meet these guys was quite intriguing to him. The one that he absolutely fell in love with on the spot was Chuck Connors from The Rifleman, because he had watched that show back in the Soviet Union. And there's a very famous photograph from that meeting where, as Brezhnev was getting ready to leave from the airport, Chuck Connors runs up, throws his arm around him, and lifts him up in a big bear hug. And the two of them really hit it off. Chuck Connors later went to the Soviet Union at Brezhnev's invitation, made a movie there, and you would never put Chuck Connors and Leonid Brezhnev somehow together mentally, and yet they have this weird connection.
Yeah. Let me introduce again our guest for anybody who might have just tuned in. We're talking with Alan Schroeder. He is Associate Professor of Journalism at Northeastern University. He is also a three-time Emmy Award-winning television producer and frequent media commentator, and he's written a book that looks at this long association of the world of show business with the world of politics, and very specifically with the presidency. The title of the book is Celebrity in Chief: How Show Business Took Over the White House, and it's published by the Westview Press. And questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, we're talking about the fact that that presidents like to associate themselves with, surround themselves with glittering people, with Hollywood types, because some of that glitter will wear off. But, of course, there are always examples where things didn't work out quite right.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that you write about in the book, and I'm sure some people, if they're of the appropriate age, will remember, was the time that Lyndon Johnson invited Eartha Kitt to the White House. And this was during the Vietnam War, and she proceeded to give him a dressing down about the war. And I'm sure that this was not what the Johnson administration had in mind when they asked her there in the first place.
No, not at all. And it shows you the potential of these encounters to backfire, because entertainers play by different rules. They're not bound by the same restrictions that politicians are. So when Eartha Kitt was invited to the White House for a luncheon of women achievers, she used the opportunity to stand up and give this very straightforward anti-Vietnam speech. And it became quite controversial, because at that point, public opinion had not totally turned against the war, and it was also one of the unusual situations in American history, this really doesn't happen very often, where somebody directly confronts a president. They're not used to that sort of behavior at all. Although she saved most of her firepower for Mrs. Johnson, and it was after LBJ left the luncheon when she really went to town and stood up and did this whole diatribe about the war. It also cost her politically, or professionally, I should say. She had a number of jobs canceled on her. She had difficulty finding work. She eventually went to Europe and built herself a career back, but it did cost her to make that stand.
And that it does strike me as a little bit unusual, because it does seem to me that, again, I'm thinking about the fact that there's sort of this mutual admiration or awe that the two groups have for one another, that most people, it seems, when they get invited to the White House are pretty much on their best behavior. I mean, there is, you know, no matter who you are, if you're a big Hollywood star, you've still got to be impressed by being in the White House, just like you or I would be. That would be a big deal about being in the White House. And it seems to me that that people, even if they're big stars, are kind of intimidated about the.
Yes, I think they are, and I think that's one of probably the last places where they would be intimidated. And so most of them are absolutely on their best behavior, and most of them are quite honored to be there. But during times of political strife, it's kind of asking for trouble in a way. Also during the Vietnam War, there was an occasion where during a state dinner, a performance after a state dinner, rather, at the White House, a backup singer with the Raycon of Singers, which was the act that had been booked, actually at the beginning of the performance unscrolled a banner that she had hidden up her sleeve about the Vietnam War and saying "Stop the killing," and obviously everyone in the room was utterly shocked. The performance was stopped. She was escorted out of the East Room by the Secret Service, interviewed, slightly detained, but then let go, basically. But there again, it's just it's so shocking when anyone would ever confront the president face to face, much less from a distance of just a few feet away like that. That it shows the volatility of some of these encounters.
Mm-hmm. It seems that of the recent administrations, the one that spent sort of the most time courting celebrities and using them kind of as fashion accessories probably was the Clinton administration.
Right.
And it's something that I think Mr. Clinton has been criticized for, that it was over, that one can understand this association and presidents going back a long way have done it. But some people have said that Clinton went somehow, there was a line and he went over it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess one of the things that I wonder about is, I think that there's probably this assumption that people in politics have, is that associating with celebrities will do something for them, whether it'll make them look more desirable, whether it'll make them look like regular guys, and whether the idea that if Barbara Streisand gives you the thumbs up, that that's somehow will mean that people out there in America will say, well, if Barbara thinks that you're great, I guess I'm going to vote for you too. It raises this question of what is that association with celebrity in the world of entertainment if you're a politician, particularly if you're president of the United States? What does that get you?
Well, it's a great question, and it's a difficult one to answer. There's one tangible thing, and that's financial contributions, and Bill Clinton is a very good example of that. The entertainment community supported him not just in a moral support kind of sense, but by writing lots and lots of checks to his campaigns and to Hillary's campaign as well. So you do, in that relationship, there is that kind of tangible result that is the contribution. Beyond that, I think that the president, if he taps into celebrities in the right way, or if he taps into the right celebrities, that he can kind of align himself with the body politic, with average people, because everybody in the country is in some way involved in popular culture. The entertainment culture in this country is so deep and resonant and a part of our everyday fabric that there's no getting away from it. So I think a president can position himself as a bit more in touch with the people if he has these alliances, but the danger is that they're either the wrong individuals or the level of the alliance somehow backfires on the president. And so highly extremely political entertainers. Barbara Streisand's a good example, maybe somebody like Charlton Heston on the Republican side. That almost signals things to the voters that perhaps a campaign would be a little leery about signaling.
Yeah. What's also interesting is that people on both sides of this relationship can be fickle. They can change their mind, and political exigency has a lot to do with it. And one of the stories I guess I'm thinking about involves Sammy Davis Jr.,
right.
One that maybe you associate with Nixon just because it was one of those uncomfortable photo op moments that we've all seen. It's not quite up there with Nixon and Elvis, but Nixon and Sammy Davis Jr.
is
kind of one of those. And it's interesting that Sammy Davis Jr. had, previous to that point, had publicly been a Democrat and a very strong supporter of John Kennedy until the day that there was some event that he had been invited to, and he ended up being disinvited.
That's right.
Because the Kennedy people thought that the fact that he was going to marry a white woman was just a little bit too much. It was too controversial. He got disinvited, and in fact that led him to change his political allegiances, and he ended up going from somebody who was a very strong supporter of John Kennedy to someone who was a strong supporter of Richard Nixon.
Yeah, that's one of the most dramatic transformations, although Frank Sinatra actually took exactly the same path. But Sammy Davis Jr. is a really interesting figure, I think, in this discussion, because he was treated very shabbily by John F. Kennedy. Sammy Davis campaigned with Sinatra and the other Rat Packers for Kennedy, raised a lot of money for him, was kind of a bit of a liaison to the African-American community on Kennedy's behalf. Then when it came time for the inauguration and the big gala show that they did in Washington, D.C., Sammy Davis Jr. was not included, and that was the first slap in the face. But the second slap in the face, and the one you're referring to, was a dinner for celebrating Lincoln's birthday, a reception rather, at the White House, to which numerous prominent African Americans were invited. And at one point, Sammy Davis Jr. was on the list, but it was right at the time he was getting ready to marry the Swedish actress May Britt, this tall, statuesque blonde. And it was too late to actually disinvite him from that party. He did show up with his wife, but JFK refused to be photographed with them and basically kept his distance and kept Jackie away from them, too, so that there would not be this photograph of him in the presence of this interracial couple. And I think that's a story that does not speak too highly of John F. Kennedy, but it shows you that for somebody like Sammy Davis Jr., that it's a complicated thing to have a relationship with a president, any president. He took an awful lot of grief for that Nixon alliance that came later on. A lot of his audience deserted him, and when he would perform, he would attract mostly white audiences after that, not the African-American audiences who had come to see him previously.
We have a caller here, and other people who would like to join the conversation certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have that toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Indiana on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
When your guest spoke about the perplexity of having Joel Gray perform, it didn't seem out of character to me at all, because I think the incident was he was at some Nazi cemetery or something and laid a wreath on some Nazi soldier, which was sort of controversial at the time. Question I was interested in, which you may have answered already, is have there been groups or a person that's been a star that's been asked to come to the White House and said, hell no, I don't believe in your politics, and, take it with you.
Yeah, there have been a number of those. Let me name a couple of them for you. The Reagan campaign tried really hard to get Bruce Springsteen, the rock singer, in its camp, and he didn't want anything to do with them. Ray Charles was invited to the White House under Nixon, I believe, and kind of realized by the timing that he must have been a replacement for somebody who had canceled. He was a little insulted by that, so he didn't come. Peter, Paul, and Mary during the Vietnam War were invited to the Lyndon Johnson White House and took the opportunity to decline because they didn't agree with his Vietnam policies. The Johnson people had a very difficult time getting people to come perform, and so ultimately they ended up doing a lot of ballet dancers and classical musicians, that sort of thing, where there wasn't quite the same level of antagonism. So yes, over the years there have been a number of people. With this current president, Van Morrison, the Irish singer, was invited to perform at the inauguration. In fact, the Bush people announced that he was performing at the inauguration, and he came out and said he had no such intention. And so, yeah, there definitely have been people who have disassociated themselves from presidents. Mm.
Other questions are certainly welcome. Again, as I said, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. There have certainly been some notable moments when presidents have actually injected themselves into show business. One need only think of Bill Clinton playing his saxophone on Arsenio Hall. That would probably be one of the great moments. But I guess I'm thinking, in looking through the book, I'm reminded of a not classic one. Some of the young people wouldn't remember this, but this would, it was the appearance of Richard Nixon, then candidate Nixon before he was elected. A very small appearance, but an appearance on the program Laugh-In. Now, if you think of all the guys who just didn't, you know, who you never think of in that role, and maybe that's why people love to remember it, those who do. You'd think, well, Nixon.
Yeah.
Kennedy, okay. He was a hip guy, Kennedy.
Uh-huh.
But not Nixon. And I guess that really was the point. Somebody had this idea that would maybe demonstrate that Nixon was a hip guy, to have this, even this small association with this, what was a very popular and happening kind of program.
His, that's right.
His famous socket to be moment.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, it came about because one of the producers of Laugh-In was a man named Paul Keyes, who had been a longtime Nixon advisor. And, you know, Nixon did, because he was from Southern California and because he represented California in Congress, he knew a lot. He knew many, many people in the show business community. His contacts were actually pretty good. So it was through this personal relationship that they decided in 1968, when he was running for president, that having Nixon on Laugh-In deliver one of the little catchphrases, the line "sock it to me." It sounds ridiculous out of context, but he just basically popped up on camera delivering this line. The style of the show was this very quick cutting series of kind of jokes and one-liners and whatnot. So Nixon, in his weird, uncomfortable way, made his appearance on Laugh-In. They also, Laugh-In also offered the Nixon opponent, Hubert Humphrey, the opportunity to come on the show and do the same thing, kind of that equal time rule, but Humphrey declined, thinking it undignified. So it is one of those weird, and there are so many with Nixon, there are so many of those weird, wonderful little moments. Another one that never happened, but you know, you almost wish that it had, was Nixon got the bright idea when he was in the White House that he wanted to stage a protest against a Broadway play popular at the time called Hair. And the thing that put Hair on the map was it was a musical, but at some point during the show, all the actors take off their clothes, and so they perform naked. Nixon was appalled by this, so he got it in his head, and he proposed this to some of his aides, who talked him out of it, that he should go to New York, go see the play, and then when they started taking off their clothes, stand up and walk out in this grand display of disgust, and make sure there were cameras there, of course, to record the whole thing. But they didn't let him do it, and it's almost too bad. That would have been one of the classic moments in American pop culture, I think.
Yeah. Well, that points out another facet, that's sort of different facet in this relationship between world of entertainment and the White House, and that is, on the one hand, presidents like the association with the glitter and the glamour, but also presidents have found it useful to slam that world, particularly
it.
on the whole family values kind of issue.
You know it. And Nixon is so interesting in that regard, in that he was not only somebody who really tried to cultivate the stars, but he put a lot of them on his enemies list. And we have something similar happening, I think, with the current administration. They have not hesitated to vilify their political enemies. Think back during the beginning of the Iraq War a year ago, the whole Dixie Chicks controversy, and the fallout from that. The Dixie Chicks, one of them made the statement in London that they were ashamed to be from Texas because that's where George W. Bush came from. And once that got out, you had quite a violent reaction. And the White House has a lot of friends in high places in the media, including the radio industry. And that clout was used to express disapproval of the Dixie Chicks. Bush himself came out and said in an interview, "Look, if they're gonna say that kind of thing, then they have to expect that there are going to be repercussions." So, Bill Maher is another example, the comedian who was who made some remarks after 9/11 that the White House did not like, and the White House press secretary came out and said people better watch what they say and watch what they do, and that show was canceled shortly thereafter. So, you know, there have been a number of intriguing relationships between the current White House and entertainers in a negative sense. And I think during the campaign, it's likely that we will see, as we've seen in past campaigns, that this question of Hollywood and its seeming lack of family values, that somebody on the Republican side is likely to try to make hay of that.
Since you mentioned it, I think the Bill Maher story is really interesting because the fact that the show was canceled has been characterized as punishment for his
right.
for what he said.
Right.
And although at the same time, I kind of think I sort of have this feeling also having read about it that what was also true was the show was just doing very poorly in the ratings.
Yeah,
and
I
that
think
it that, may well
think,
have been canceled anyway.
Yeah, I think that's a fair bit of context for that. Now, there were individual cities where it was pulled more, I think, out of reactions from the viewers who were very pro-Bush. I'm thinking in Houston, for instance. He had a lot of trouble with the show in Houston. He made a crack about Barbara Bush one time that didn't go over too well in that city, and the local affiliate took him off, at least temporarily. So I think it was a combination of things. But, yeah, I take your point that mm-hmm. perhaps the ratings, or should I say, if the ratings had been through the roof, I don't think the politics would have pulled him off the air.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you can say about the world of show business is that if you're making money, you can do anything. You can almost say anything if you got the numbers.
Yeah, no, that's right. And there's been a current interesting thing going on, which is where television shows in Hollywood are putting messages into their everyday scripts that are sort of not so subtle digs on George W. Bush. There was a George W. Bush lookalike character on the Whoopi Goldberg sitcom. There have been other references in shows like Curb Your Enthusiasm and even Law and Order, The Practice. So, you know, it's a two-way street, and politicians don't hesitate to criticize entertainers. So I guess we shouldn't expect the opposite as well, or we should expect the opposite, because of course entertainers have their platform and they're going to use it.
Sure. We have a caller we'll get right to. Just maybe I should introduce again the guest. We're talking with Alan Schroeder. He's professor of journalism at Northeastern University. He also is a three-time Emmy Award-winning TV producer and frequent commentator on media. His book is Celebrity in Chief, How Show Business Took Over the White House, published by Westview Press. We have a caller up next in Charleston. That would be line number 4. Hello.
Yes. I'm wondering if your guest might have researched any antique or before radio and TV and movies of this practice in ancient times, and or, you know, before media was as large as it is now, that they would have practiced some of these very same things during those times as they are done today.
It's an interesting question. I don't have much information on it. However, my sense is that what really got this thing going was the arrival of mass media, and that before that you may have had some isolated incidents of it. But, of course, the other thing to bear in mind is that presidential candidates didn't ever really even come out in public until this century. Usually their surrogates would campaign on behalf of them, but you didn't have presidential candidates and presidents in the 1800s going out giving campaign speeches or attending rallies or that kind of thing. So the whole notion of of sort of politics as entertainment had less to do with the individual candidates back then, just by definition. So it would be an interesting process, and I don't know, it'd be difficult to track down information on all of that, but my sense is that there wasn't a whole heck of a lot of it.
Well, it makes me think in the terms of newspapers, you know, which I've been since Gutenberg, and that media, which was a form of entertainment, that's what struck me, that there may have been some even preceding that. But newspapers have, in since they came into existence, have played a larger role, have they not, in politics and such?
Oh, yeah, because, of course, in the 1800s, it was a largely partisan press. So the newspaper you read reflected your political point of view, and some of the things that were written, the columns and so forth, were every bit as nasty and vindictive as what you're going to see on cable television or here on radio talk shows today. So in that sense, politics as entertainment for the masses, yes, but in the sense of the individual candidates kind of presenting themselves as entertainers or in the company of entertainers, not so much.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for the call. And again, other people who have questions can call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. It seems that a lot of the stories here, a lot of the good stories have to do with Nixon. And I wanted to get at another one, and that is, as you write in the book, what may have been one of the strangest meetings ever to take place in the Oval Office, which was Nixon and Elvis. And knowing what we know about Elvis Presley, what makes it even stranger is that apparently Elvis showed up uninvited, showed up wanting to offer his services in the war against drugs.
Right. Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And who better than Elvis?
Who better than Elvis, yeah.
to know the ins and outs of that. Yeah, it's a very weird story on every level. It's even weirder than I think people realize just from looking at the pictures, because, as you say, he showed up uninvited, which nobody ever does at the White House and expects to get an audience, but he was Elvis. And so he showed up uninvited, leaves a note early in the morning before any of the staff have even gotten there at the White House gate saying, "I'm Elvis, I'm at the Hotel Washington, I'd like to meet the president," left it with a guard. It goes to a fairly low-level functionary who dealt with drug issues for the White House because of this connection, and they kind of do a pre-interview with Elvis. They make him come to the staff member's office first. They kind of check the situation out, and they send it up the line, and the next thing you know, a few hours later, Elvis is in the White House with the President of the United States, and they have this famous meeting where Elvis offers his services as kind of a roving ambassador to youth, and he asks, and really his whole purpose in being there, he asks Nixon, "Can I have a federal narcotics badge?" Elvis collected these badges anytime he would go perform a concert in a given city. The local police department would give him one of these badges, and so he had this whole collection, and he wanted one from Nixon. And before the end of the meeting, he had his badge. I don't think he literally walked out with it. Nixon didn't have them right there, but he certainly got the ball rolling on it. He also brought Nixon a present, which he was not able to deliver because the present was a gun, and you don't just show up at the White House packing heat, as he did. So the Secret Service clearly were not too happy about that. They took the gun away from him. You can see the gun now at the Nixon Library out in Yorba Linda, California. But they did have this memorable, wacky meeting, and thank God the photographs of that episode survive, and they're fascinating to look at.
We have someone here calling on a mobile phone, cell phone, so we'll go there. Line one. Hello.
Yes, hello, Professor Schroeder. I trust that we're not having another example of media bias, and that I got into your program after it started, but I haven't heard any examples that you're drawing from the Clinton White House. And I recall the Tiger Woods situation, and perhaps there were others. Perhaps you could inform us as to those situations.
Yeah, Tiger Woods was invited to the White House and didn't show up, I don't remember all of the circumstances of that. I don't remember others with Clinton particularly. I mean, believe me, though, this is not a partisan issue, any of this discussion, because there's plenty of good and bad on both sides. I mean, if you want an example of something that Clinton did that was negative as far as stars go, I think he probably gave some of them a little too much access to the White House. You know, you had John Travolta getting a briefing with the National Security Advisor, and Travolta's issue was Scientology. Although I should point out that Tom Cruise went to the Bush White House with a similar plea, and he had an audience with, I believe it was the Secretary of Education. But my point is that there are positive examples of interactions between presidents and entertainers on both sides of the fence. I think that there just have been more interactions with Democrats, probably because there seems to be more of a kinship there.
Well, I hope that gets to the question of the caller. Others, again, are welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I guess when in the interest of bipartisanship, maybe we should talk a little bit about John Kennedy, since we've talked about the fact, and you talk about the fact in the book, that maybe the beginnings of this real relationship as it is today, it does have to do with mass media, and you start to see it with the Franklin Roosevelt, but that the person who made most of it probably was John Kennedy, because he was somebody who was comfortable with traveling in those circles.
Right.
Although, on the other hand, I suppose that there, if you're looking at controversial connections between presidents and the world of show business, that's also the guy that you're going to look at.
Yeah, I think so. Well, and of course, the difference between Kennedy and Roosevelt is Roosevelt came along for radio, Kennedy came along for television, and television, rightly or wrongly, had more influence and certainly more of a visceral connection to audiences. But what people forget about Kennedy that's so interesting to me is that he grew up with show business because his father was a movie producer. So when Kennedy was a little boy, his dad was out in Hollywood making movies with, of course, his Gloria Swanson, his mistress, but people like Tom Mix, the cowboy star, and a number of other people. And so young John Kennedy was quite comfortable in the world of Hollywood, in the world of movies, because these were his father's business associates. He met quite a few of them when he was a kid. When JFK was a teenager, during a family vacation, he danced with Marlena Dietrich, who happened to be there with her family at this resort in the south of France. So Kennedy was just steeped in it from the very, very beginning. It's interesting, though, if you go back and look at his real early TV appearances, he wasn't naturally comfortable, right from the get-go. He worked on it, and he got better as he went along. He made a famous appearance in 1960 on The Tonight Show. He was one of the first entertainers to really go that route. And I saw that at the Kennedy Library. I watched it. He was actually quite charming and funny on the show. But he got third billing that night. They brought him out after Anne Bancroft and Peggy Cass. There's a name for your older viewers or listeners. It's hard to believe that John F. Kennedy could ever play third fiddle to anybody, much less Anne Bancroft and Peggy Cass. But there you go.
Some other callers here. People, again, on cell phones. We'll go to line one first. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Going back to the perhaps early ages, 1930s, there was, a radio, the equivalent of a radio show by a Father Coughlin or something like Coughlin?
Yes. Uh-huh.
He was in favor of and then treated... not in favor of the Roosevelt White House. What was the story on that?
Well, I don't know a great deal about this. I know that Father Coughlin was a popular radio personality, we should say, in the 1930s, who preached a very right-wing message and was pretty controversial. I don't know enough really to comment about his relationship with Roosevelt. He falls a bit outside my area of expertise here.
Thank you, Mark.
All right, let's go to line number two. This is also a caller on cell phone. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just wanted to comment about the visitors to the White House attacking the president. It seems to me that goes beyond the bounds of politics. You don't expect that anyone that comes to your home, I mean, if you invite somebody to your home or if you are invited to somebody's home, it certainly is beyond the bounds of courtesy and normal courtesy to then turn around and criticize your host. So it seems to me that an act like that is is not only politically gauche, but it's just from ordinary common sense, is something that one shouldn't do.
Yes, I agree with that. And I think that that's why there was such a strong negative reaction to Eartha Kitt, was that she had sort of insulted the Johnsons, not just in a public way, but also privately, just as human to human, that is not a very nice way to approach people.
Generally, we've talked a little bit about this in a couple of cases, but there is this basic idea, I think we expect, that one of the reasons that presidents would like to associate with entertainers, with famous people, is that some of that glamour will rub off on them, will brush off on them. And as far as people in Hollywood are concerned, there may indeed be some of the same expectation. So, and I guess in the same way that I asked the question about whether it was good for presidents to be associated with entertainers, does that work the other way around? And is it in fact good for entertainers in their career as entertainers to be associated with the President of the United States?
It can be. There's a quote that I like a lot from Katharine Hepburn, and Katharine Hepburn was actually describing the relationship between Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire, and she said, "She gives him sex, he gives her class." And that's kind of what this relationship between presidents and entertainers are, that they can kind of sex up a presidency just because of their image. They're more fun, they're more glamorous, they're more beautiful. And the president, in return, gives the entertainers class, that they're taken more seriously, that they're not just little wind-up dolls that go out and put on a show. There's something more substantial than that. And that's a hunger that a lot of entertainers feel, that they're not taken seriously for their intellect or their minds, but just their looks and their God-given singing talents or what have you. So that relationship definitely cuts both ways, and there is something very clear in it for each of the individual parties that makes a certain amount of sense, I think.
Let's take another call here. Urbana, line one.
Good morning. I'm really interested in your program. I don't have my details, but a year or so ago at the Academy Award, Michael somebody accepting the Oscar made a statement about shame, shame, Mr. Bush.
Yes.
And it seemed to me, and I'd certainly like to have your comments on it, that the audience, picking up on what the last caller said, or caller before, was not responsive to that, not that they didn't agree, but that they thought it was inappropriate because
yes.
of the lack of applause. But I'd like to have your take on it, please.
Yes, that was Michael Moore, the independent
yes.
documentary filmmaker
yes.
who won the Academy Award last year
right.
for the film Bowling for Columbine.
Okay.
And this was right at the time that the country was just getting ready to go into the Iraq War, so the tensions were pretty high already.
Right.
Yeah, he gets up, accepts his award, and starts berating President Bush.
Absolutely.
Yeah, with this prepared speech, and he says, shame on you, shame
yes.
on you, shame on you.
Yes.
He referred to him as the fictitious president and starting a fictitious war and on and on. And it did backfire on him. And I agree with you. I think the people in the audience, the liberal community in Hollywood, that their sympathies with that point of view were probably pretty much in line.
Absolutely.
However, it's a question of, is that the appropriate venue?
Absolutely.
And he pretty much was thought to have crossed the line. It's interesting about Michael Moore. He comes back up in the current election in another controversial context, and that is that during the New Hampshire primary season, he appeared with Wesley Clark, whom he was supporting, at a rally. And during that rally, he referred to George W. Bush as a deserter. And this kind of sparked that whole discussion about Bush's National Guard service.
Yes.
But it backfired on, in this case, not Michael Moore, but Wesley Clark, because
uh-huh.
Clark didn't differentiate, didn't comment, or didn't distance himself from Moore. And he was asked about it for several days running on the campaign trail, and it became a distraction right at a point when Wesley Clark was trying to, distinguish himself in a positive way. So, yeah, Michael Moore so far has sort of been a bit of a live wire for both sides.
Well, he's a liability, it sounds as if. I'm a Bush supporter, but I'm a fair person. And when I was watching that program, I was just shocked.
Yeah.
I think I would have been just as shocked if there had been a Democratic president in and someone whom I might have agreed with had said similar comments. I just thought it was inappropriate. That's not the venue.
Yeah, and you're certainly not the only one who felt that way, and I think even people who sympathize with the remarks probably
yes.
Didn't like the circumstances of it or the tone of it.
Well, I respect your view, and I didn't want to be so, you know, one-sided that maybe I was looking at it in the wrong way.
Thank you.
We have a couple minutes left here. You know, there's something that we haven't talked about at all that's yet another really interesting dimension of this, and that's the degree to which the White House and the presidency has looked to Hollywood to learn things about how messages should be presented, how the president should be presented. I'd probably end up being accused of being partisan once again, but it does seem that this is something that Republicans have been much better at than Democrats. And really starting with Ronald Reagan, they started paying a much, much more attention to how the president was presented.
Yeah, although I think it predates Reagan. I think Kennedy was really the first one because, you know, you just think even today of the photographs and the moving footage that exists of Kennedy with his family and in unguarded moments. And, of course, that was all thought about. That was all kind of strategized because they knew the value of those images. Reagan perfected it in the sense that that they took it to new levels. They looked at camera angles. I interviewed Michael Deaver, Reagan's media guru, and you know, he talked about how they loved to get the photographers below Reagan shooting up because his shoulders were broad and you got this kind of empowering angle on him, and they were very careful about the lighting and they were very careful about the colors that he wore and all of that sort of stuff. And of course, as a Hollywood actor, he had been sensitized to all of those external things. Reagan loved being photographed by still photographers, for instance, much more than by moving photographers much more than still photographers, because he knew that you could isolate moments of ugliness in a still photograph, but if you keep moving, if you're in video or motion pictures, that you present, you know, a more favorable image of yourself. So he was quite good at that. But I would also say, you know, Clinton was awfully good at that and took it to new heights. So I don't see this as a partisan issue. I don't think anybody has an advantage over the other. I think they all do it. They all do it to the degree that they can and as best they can, and we probably can expect them to even concentrate on these things even more in the future.
Well, that's where I guess I would want to end up, and unfortunately we're almost out of time, but just not very long ago I talked with the fellow who was, I'm sorry, I forget his name, who was hired as the joke writer for Clinton.
Mark Katz,
who wrote this book kind of about his experiences and the fact that there are these four dinners that take place in Washington where, and a lot of them are involve media people and correspondents, and the president makes an appearance, and the president is expected to stand up there and tell jokes
funny.
So they brought this guy in to write these four humor speeches for the president. And it's interesting, one of the things we talked about is that the increasing expectation that the president can step into that role, can be an entertainer, can do stand-up,
right,
and be good at it and get laughs. And it was very important for him to be successful. So to the extent that the Clinton people actually brought in this guy just to do that. So it makes you wonder what, you know, in future, the celebrity quotient, is that going to become, you know, it's not that it's not important now, but is that going to become even more important?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, that we have such high expectations of presidents and their abilities to not only lead the country, but to deliver a message cogently and interestingly, and even entertain us to a certain degree. And the more we see presidents like Reagan and Clinton and Kennedy, who are really fluent in that, the higher the bar is raised for future politicians. So I do see this as a trend that will probably only intensify.
Well, thank you very much. We're going to have to leave it there. We appreciate it. Alan Schroeder from Northeastern University. He teaches journalism there. The book is Celebrity in Chief, How Show Business Took Over the White House. We appreciate it very much, Professor Schroeder.
Thank you, David. Good job. I really appreciated the interview.